A4. The Structure Principle of Being. Our Need for a Divine System of Reference. Number 1A.
Well, the title of this class is The Seven Synonymous Terms for God, the Structure Principle of Being. This class builds on two other classes that have been taped before, namely first on my class called An Introduction into the Science of Christian Science, which I have given way back in 1962, and which is taped and available, and which gives a introduction to the absolute newcomer. And second, it is built on a series of talks given by Joel Chesson during 1972-74 on the seven synonymous terms for God. So this present class builds a bridge from those two classes to the various subjects which I have been presenting for the last few years here in America and in Europe, and which have been taped, classes which naturally build on a knowledge of what we do today or on those two series which I have been talking about just now. So this present class, so to say, is geared to build a bridge between these preceding taped classes and that vast presentation of the subject of Christian Science as we see it today, which includes the more comprehensive sense relating to those subjects like the four level of spiritual consciousness, subjects like structure in Christian Science, like matrices, and the whole system of Christian Science. So this is a bridge, but in order to find our foothold, so to say, I want to warm up the subject a little bit today, to warm up what you are supposed to have been studying for this class, and therefore I will repeat various points that perhaps is already known to you. But it's necessary in order just to warm up the whole atmosphere so that we find the connection with the actual subject which we want to deal with this week. It is always good to ask oneself, what are the great, big, fundamental questions in a subject like Christian Science? And I would say that this week we will ask four big questions. The first big question is, what is reality? And then the second big question will be, how are we one with that reality? Just showing that it is not enough, really, to state what reality is, but we must have a feeling that we are one with that reality, so that reality is not just something outside of us, far away from us, something up in heaven or wherever it is, but that we are the very presence of that reality. So that great second question will deal with the method of how to be one with that reality. Then we'll touch on the third big question, namely that when we are one with that big reality, how do we practice from that standpoint? So it will be the question of practice in reality. And fourth, if we have time, I never know how much I can cover. Fourth, I would like just to touch a little bit on the scientific structure of reality, and therefore give an introduction to those many subjects which I have been taping for the last 4 or 5 years. Yes. So we start with that first great question, which will occupy our thoughts for quite a while this week, because we have first to know what reality is before we have any chance to be one with reality. The first point is A, capital A, materialism versus idealism. You know that for the last 2,000 years. This question of materialism versus idealism has been the great problem of all the thinkers in the world. The great question of the biblical scholars, but also of the philosophers since the Greek period. Well, it was always the question, what is real? Is matter real? Is mentality, the ideal, real? Are ideas real? Is that which is immaterial, is that real? And so from time to time you had an ebb and flow of these two great strains of thought, sometimes a period where everything was pointing that matter is real, then usually you had another period that followed, bringing forth the idea that the ideal, the ideational is real, and that went on through those last 2,000 years over and over. With the Renaissance, we had a great turning point, as you know, in the 16th, 17th century. With the Renaissance, really the Renaissance was the rebirth of classical Greek thought, and we have there those first big scientists, natural scientists, like Kepler, Galilei, Newton. And these people were stressing more and more that matter is real, though we must not forget, though they are, so to say, the forefathers, really those who have given us the basis for material science, for physics, for natural science, these people still had a great idealism. They were still very religious in their mind and were believing in the harmony of being and the harmony of the spheres, and we are somehow believing that there is a reality above that which they were investigating as material and natural laws. Even Newton, who seemed to be the toughest of those in the way of giving a materialistic basis for the centuries to come, it is said that even he was writing about a million words on occult themes, so that it gives an idea that he, too, still was in that realm where he believed that that which is immaterial had also some kind of reality and has to be considered. But with the middle of the 19th century, we really came to a climax of materialism, where the universe was regarded to be only material, where nothing mattered anymore but material laws. They rule the universe, it was believed, and that we have to submit ourselves to all these material laws. At that point, we could perhaps summarize in our terminology, it was believed that matter is intelligent, that matter is substance and real, that there is no reality called soul. No soul existed for them. That we have to obey scientific laws, material laws, that life is utterly material, that the only true facts that there are material facts, and that matter is ruled by the law of causality, determined by the law of causality. In short, we could say it is the period of matter over mind. That was the climate, so to say, in which Christian Science was born and really took up the sword, so to say, in order to combat that terrific materialistic sense that was prevalent 100 years ago. What is the development since that time? I come now to point one here under capital A, developments in the mental realm. And I adjust that presentation, so to say, to the Christian Science thought, because we are somehow informed about Mesmer and his experiments he made at that time, trying to still to show in that typical material age that there is an invisible fluid, material fluid, that could be geared and channelized such that it would have its impact on the body and therefore on the health of people. He was not considering anything psychic or mental in his theory. But already his pupil, even during his lifetime, that pupil, which perhaps you know as the Marquis de Puységur, he found out one day that when he was treating a patient according to Mesmer's theory, that something interesting happened. That he found out that putting a patient into a magnetic sleep, which is similar to somnambulism, that in that magnetic sleep, the patient began to develop qualities, faculties that were unknown up to that point. That he became transparent, so to say, clairvoyant, and began to see things which with the ordinary physical senses one couldn't see, that he could analyze, so to say, the disease of a person, that he could see what happens in the future or what happens at another place, so that whole faculty of clairvoyancy was discovered. This was a terrific step because it showed somehow the power of mind over matter. Suddenly, the whole thing turned around. Instead of believing that power of matter over mind, there is a power of matter over mind, it turned to the other way of the power of mind over matter. And that in that state of somnambulism or hypnotic sleep, the subject could perform things that other people in their waking state would not be able to perform. Today, perhaps we will call it was an extension of consciousness, an expansion of consciousness that they could witness. And from that point on, we see a whole development of mind over matter. We have, at that time, a very famous man in France, Deleuze, who began to see that with magnetic treatment, one could heal people. Whereas Mesmer believed that a material fluid would influence the state of health of his patient, Deleuze began to see that a magnetic sleep, therefore mentalism, was able to help people physically. But he also began to see already that a magnetizer has to be a good man and not a bad man, that he must have good morals and a high ethical standard, because he already could perceive that with that mind one could also do harm to a patient. So that mind over matter was not so good as it looked like at the beginning. That mind over matter could be misused for evil purposes. Then we have a further development with the Abbé de Faria. He showed that it isn't so, that the magnetizer with his will could put a patient asleep, but that the patient himself, by staring to his hand, which he has raised up, by staring to his hand, would fall into a magnetic sleep. And so they began to realize that each person by himself could magnetize himself and therefore influence his whole state of bodily and being, so that each one was responsible, so to say, for the state of mind, and through that state of mind would influence, be responsible for his state of health or of corporeal being. Shortly after, they began to see that two doctors were especially involved in that, Ude and Estay, that they could perform surgical operations through hypnotism, through hypnotic sleep. They could put people asleep and then operate on them without that the patient would feel any pain. And you could see how more and more this mind over matter business was being put at use for healing purposes. This whole trend then became academically, what shall I say, accepted with James Braid in England, a doctor who began really to see that the patient can be put asleep and in a hypnotic state by just watching a glaring object, and by staring at that glaring object, the patient would fall in such deep sleep that they could also perform operations on them. He showed it in such a convincing way that even the medical faculty had to accept the phenomena. One step further was that at that time in France, we have the development of another line under Charcot. Charcot appears several times in the Christian Science Journal at that time, being a very good example of how through magnetism and suggestion he could put sensitive people in such a state that they could be healed of incurable diseases, of some incurable diseases. But when they would wake up out of their sleep, they would fall back right away into the old state of disease. Charcot was very well known at that time. He had a great international reputation. But he also showed something more, that he could transfer on his subjects, which he put into sleep, other diseases. So he could produce disease and take it away in the same session. And he performed that in front of the whole public that want to come to these sessions at the La Salpêtrière in Paris. He was then fought by another line of thinking, which is called the Nancy School, with those two big names, Libyaux and Bernheim, who began to see that through suggestion they could influence a patient, that the patient would be put under the suggestions of the doctor, suggesting to the patient health and thereby being healed. A further line of it was, I think you perhaps know him, the French Gouet and Gouetism, which went just one step further and showed that there is not only the phenomena of suggestion of doctor to patient, but also auto-suggestion, where each one could, by repetition of the same positive statement, fall into that suggestion of believing what he is suggesting. And so, you know, Gouetism, which goes mostly under the term, every day I get better and better. Every day and under every circumstance I get better and better. And by suggesting that constantly to one's consciousness, one would experience this very improvement in health. A further development you have with Schultz in our days, with that whole autogenic training, which I think you know, because many of the, now I'm not quite sure if it are the astronauts or the cosmonauts, are trained in that way to lose all their fears and get rid of all their limitations in thinking. So you can see there was a great line of development, one leading to the other, all in that line showing that mind has power over matter. With that mind, naturally we mean mortal mind, the human mind, and not the divine mind. And we have also parallel with this development the investigation really of the unconscious and the subconscious realm of the human mind. It is only in 1868, you see, around about Mrs. Eddy's discovery of Christian Science, that over in Germany, for the first time, they began to become interested in the unconscious human mind, like Hartmann. Did I put him down? Let me see. Yes, like von Hartmann. He wrote his first book on psyche, which is a philosophy of the unconscious. You see, parallel with the French development, which was very practical and pragmatic in their youth, because they were interested how to use the human mind for practical use, like healing the sick. The Germans were at that time much more idealistic, and they saw that through the discovery of the unconscious, they would perhaps find a way of expanding consciousness to the utopia of the Romantic period at that time. Later on, we have in America, in Boston, that great medical man, Hudson, who for the first time wrote a book in which he showed that there is a conscious and an unconscious element in the human mind. So if for the first time he began to divide up the human mind into two realms, into the conscious realm and into the unconscious realm. And with that point, he really started a complete new era in the investigation of the subconscious and unconscious. That whole development of the subconscious is really then brought forth by the father of the subconscious, the French Janet. He's considered, so to say, the father of the modern psychology, Janet, with his psychological analysis. He was the one that tried to show that we have to go deeper into the psyche of a man and not just say, well, the psyche of a man is something that has to be considered, but to analyze it and see what the structure of the psyche is. He is, so to say, the father of those three big ones, Freud, Adler, and Jung, which you know. Freud, who was founding psychoanalysis, and his main object was to investigate the sexual drive in men, and was thinking that everything that goes wrong in the human life and in one's health can be traced back to sexual problems.